This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month's announcement that the U.S. and Cuba will restore diplomatic relations sparked a barrage of speculation. What will the historic thawing mean for diplomatic relations between the two nations, for international trade, tourism industry, human rights? Here to ponder another sweeping change for Cuba is Rob Fleischman, Chief Technology Officer at Zerocoal and Word of Mouth's Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. He's with us to answer the question, what does this mean for Cuba's internet infrastructure and wired technology? Rob, great to see you.
Wonderful to be here, Virginia.
So how many people do have internet access in Cuba now?
Well, there are about 2.5 to 3 million people in Cuba that have, I would say, regular access to the internet. And that's 20 to 25% of the country. So that's a really low number relative to, you know, pretty much any developed country. Their access is slow. It's actually terrible. Expensive, slow, intermittent. Very, very low quality, harkens back to our dial-up days here in the U.S. Probably bad dial-up would be what I would compare it to.
And censored?
Yes, censored heavily as well. But, you know, there's another thing to think about here, and that is even simple things like mobile phone penetration in Cuba is bad. So, you know, when less than 20% of the population has a mobile phone at all, you know, when you start thinking about 25% having internet, it's really not that bad. You know, I'm just saying – the internet access isn't the only technology that hasn't penetrated deeply in Cuba. So yes, you know, internet is run by ICT, Information and Communications Technology branch of the Cuban government. Access is highly restricted. For the most part, hotels have it. Government agencies have it. Very few people have it. If you want to use the internet, you need to identify yourself. When you go to a place, you need to be checked out. You need to be approved. You know, it's not... it's not you and me walking down the street, whipping out our smartphone and, you know, checking out Google. Mm-hmm. It's not that at all.
And I understand unfettered access, even as low as 5% of the
people. Oh, yeah. Unfettered is, you know, almost unheard of. I mean, that you have to be somebody.
Now, so why is this? Is it strictly geopolitical or censorship or infrastructure?
Well, that's really great. You know, I mean, admittingly, I've never been to Cuba myself, and I'm certainly not a politician. But I can tell you the technology story. And the story is pre-late 2012, Cuba mostly had satellite. They had no physical high-speed connection. Even to this day, cable TV, satellite TV is illegal. Mm-hmm. You know, as an individual, you can't buy that stuff and run it. So high-speed access just never existed. The government didn't have high-speed access. There's a lot of political rhetoric. It's the U.S.'s fault. We have these terrible satellite connections. Blame the U.S., blame the U.S. Very easy, believable, and maybe true politics. But then in 2012, a high-speed fiber optic cable was built. It's called the Alba One Project. And that cable came from Venezuela. Venezuela has decent internet connectivity, multiple connections there, multiple providers, plenty of technology, real internet in Venezuela. So those folks ran an undersea cable to Jamaica, and they extended that cable to Cuba. So that arrived in January 2013. Mm-hmm. So this isn't really talked about. So, you know, I mean, it's been a ways since January 2013.
But still, I'm thinking one pipeline for
That's correct. One pipeline for the entire nation. Now, it is fiber, so it is fast. So, you know, let's be honest, there are businesses here in the U.S. and maybe even homeowners with Fios from Verizon that have equivalent connectivity in their homes that the entire Cuban country has. But nevertheless, that fiber cable is a massive upgrade from where they once were. So what happened with that fiber cable? It went live in January 2013. Today, many of the online internet sites that track routing and use of cables and things like that show about 1,000 to maybe 1,100 machines actively using that connection. I suspect all of them are government. I expect none of them are people. I expect that cable has not been utilized by any individuals to any real extent. So although their physical connectivity to the internet has improved dramatically, it's still horrible, and that horrible thing is hardly used by the population.
Mm-hmm. So, I actually have been to Cuba a couple times, and I've seen on hotel televisions they have cable.
Yes.
In hotels, they often have sort of internet cafes and internet access.
That's expensive hotels, stuff, right? I mean, it's very expensive.
Right.
I mean, you're paying
so how,
dollars per hour to use those poorly connected, generally satellite internet, satellite TV connections to the internet. And you know, they're in the hotels, right? I mean, you walk down the street, the guy next door to the hotel, he's got nothing.
So these are in the hotels where people who work in the tourism industry might have access, or somebody who works with somebody who works in the tourism industry might have access. So how is the public actually consuming pop culture news, internet content?
Well, one of the things that goes on there is what I call sneakernet. They call it the package. And the idea here is someone grabs some content illegally, maybe by a rogue satellite uplink, or maybe they work in one of these hotels and download a bunch of stuff, digitize it, stick it on a USB hard drive or on a physical hard drive. And, you know, nowadays, some of those hard drives are small and have very high capacity. So I take this hard drive. It's got, you know, today's cool copies of,
El Sábado Gigante.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, television from Venezuela, from Mexico.
Absolutely. Content, right? Content.
And
cool
the U.S.,
content.
A lot of
YouTube
US
videos, television content, cable TV shows, movies, what have you, gotten surreptitiously, gotten illegally, however. And they duplicate this and pass it around.
And they charge for it.
Right. It's a business, right? I mean, it's the black market. It's digital black market. Right here, I got this USB drive. Give me $5 and you can have a copy. You know, I mean, it's guys walking around with a suitcase or a pocketbook or, a laptop full of digital information that they sell. And people want it. People buy it. And they might give them $5 for this week's set of stuff. Next week, it's another $5, mm-hmm. And it's a market. But it's funny. I mean, it's sneaker net, right? I mean, literally, you're taking the content and handing it from person to person. And they're copying it and archiving it and doing whatever they need to do. It's sort of a blessing, right? I mean, it's sort of technology, right? It's only possible because the density of storage is so high. You can put movies and lots of them in a very small space, mm-hmm. and hand it to your friend.
Well, and from what I understand from people there, the packet – The El Paquete Semanal, the weekly packet, costs a lot at the beginning of the week, and it goes down in
price.
Right,
it goes down because everyone's ripping it. You know, everyone's copying it. And, you know, on Friday, you want last week's stuff. It's like the news, right? I mean, the 6 o'clock news is great, but 3 days from now, you can give it away for free.
Rob Fleischman is with me today, and we're talking about what the restoration of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba will mean for Cuba's internet access and infrastructure, which has been deeply restricted.
Right.
So the announcement of normalized relations between the U.S. and Cuba included language specifically,
yes,
about allowing American companies to export communications technology.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
Well, that's interesting. You know, it's vague. I'll put on my crystal ball and I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. I think the first thing that folks are really talking about is basic communication. So my belief is mobile phones, more of our mobile technology will get there. Penetration of mobile phones will go up. The quality of those mobile phones will go up. It's not just going to be audio and, you know, you're going to get 3G and LTE and all the cool technology that we have that allows smartphones, high-speed data and that stuff to be available mobily.
And will they operate with mobile phone towers so far away?
Well, I think there are going to be some built, but I think the government is going to be tough about that. I think they're going to be slow and controlled and try and maintain their grip. You know, maybe China-like. Maybe China-like.
I was wondering if China is a model here because, you know, there was this idea that once the internet hit China, things would open up tremendously. Mm-hmm. But the government has been able to still keep a pretty strong lid on it. So what's the incentive for an American company going into Cuba when there is still going to be tight controls? Will they be tiptoeing around like Google in China, for example?
Well, Google in China is a different situation than somebody like a Motorola or an LG, right, who sells handsets. You know, I mean, quite frankly, Motorola looks at it and says, hey, there are all these people. They have terrible handsets. We have great handsets. LG, we have great handsets. Samsung, great handsets. Apple, more handsets. They look at it and say, we're going to make money on these handsets and we're going to sell tons of them. And if the content's filtered, you know, we're not happy about that. But, you know, there's still business there.
Mm-hmm.
Folks in the content business, yes, they're much more challenged, right? I mean, if you are someone like a Google who provides open access and that's sort of your mantra, Cuba's going to be more challenging because they're not going to allow that. And I think that, you know, we're being incredibly idealistic, and we'd all like to be, that we think that these rulings and agreements between the U.S. and Cuba are going to open up Cuba, and all of a sudden, you know, the average Cuban is going to have access to everything we do, and the walls are going to come down, and they're going to see the light of democracy and open access, and all the lies or pseudo-lies or spin that their government has told them is going to be torn down by their access to open information. That's kind of ideal. I don't think that's going to happen at all, because I don't think the government's motivated to do that. I don't see what their upside is to that. So my belief is that there's going to be a trickle of new technology in there, starting with mobile, because that really builds infrastructure. The government, I think, will then be motivated to build towers and networks inside. And mobile penetration actually is also easier and cheaper, right? You don't have to wire cables or put fiber optic all over the place. You know, it's easy. Hand out a bunch of handsets, set up a bunch of towers, run fiber to those. There's some infrastructure that's needed there, obviously, but it's a lot cheaper, easier, and also easier to control by the government if you go that direction. So that's my crystal ball guess. I mean, if I were employed by Cuba as the chief information officer, that's what I would do. I would go in that direction.
Is that the job you're going for now, Rob?
It is not. It is not among the next career choices for me.
Okay, so how quickly do you think this will happen?
Oh, I don't think you're going to see anything until the end of 2015. I don't think you see anything.
All right. Crystal ball from Rob Fleischman, our chief seer of all things Wired. He's also chief technology officer at ZeroCoal. Rob, thanks so much.
Always great to be here, Virginia.
Stick around for more word of mouth. Up next, we're going to crack the books on our new series, The Uncommon Core, conversations with professors who teach unorthodox college courses. We're going to find out what the course Invented Languages, Klingon and Beyond, is all about. That's when word of mouth continues after a short break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. We've been working behind the scenes here since the start of the school year, talking to college professors from around the country who are educating students in unexpected ways. With the spring semester about to begin, we present those conversations in a new series we're calling The Uncommon Core. We begin with a West Coast professor who turned his affection for science fiction into a collegiate-level learning opportunity.
Hi, I'm Doug Bigham. I am an assistant professor of linguistics at San Diego State University, and I teach a course called Invented Languages, Klingon and Beyond. So I wanted to start teaching this course because I wanted a way to engage students in linguistics without having to actually teach them linguistics. I wanted a kind of pop culture, you know, back road into linguistics. Also, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so... Klingon is a good language to start teaching students about linguistics with because it's this language that was created in order to sound alien. It was purposefully designed by its creator, Mark Okrand, in order to sound like a language that you wouldn't find on Earth. It violates all of these linguistic rules that we have, and so by looking at how it violates them, then we can start looking at what those universals might be for human languages and why they might be there to begin with, and things like that. Some of the other languages that I teach besides Klingon include Esperanto, which was this language created in the 19th century in order to be a world second language. Dothraki, which is popular from the Game of Thrones series. This language called Solresol, which was again created in the 19th century, intended to be this world language, but it's based off of the musical scale. One of the ways that my class really gets at linguistics in a way that linguistics classes can't, all of these weird things that students always want to talk about, you know, they say, hey, you know, isn't it weird that when languages don't have a word for the color blue, that means they can't think about the color blue? And I have to say, you know, no, that's not true. That's not really how human language works. But when we talk about constructed and invented languages, then they can say these things, and I can say, yeah, wouldn't it be cool if there were a language that did that? constructed languages allow us to see the ways that language could be if it were freed of all of the historical baggage that real languages have to deal with.
You had to learn to speak Elvish for the role that you play.
I did.
And I'm just curious, do you feel it's like a sexy language?
Like sensual, maybe more than sexy. It's very sensual. You know, there's like the tapped R, which is the sensual Spanish sound, and then French vowels, which how sexy are French
can
vowels?
Can you give me a little Elvish right now? Do you mind?
Oh, okay. So one thing I could say is Hirnin Legolas. But like even sexier, there's the word friend in Elvish. It's Melon.
Melon.
The thing that students seem to really respond to in the class is this sudden awareness they have around mid-semester that linguistics is all around them. Like, they've always, you know, had this awareness that language is all around them, but suddenly they start to take language apart as this object. They start to see it as this thing that can be toyed with and manipulated. They start to see it as this artifact of culture, kind of like you see art or music, and they start to see language as like this objective thing that they can start inspecting, I guess.
Ejim tafe deja e, ejim sotas gos vaskrar baitik.
Okay, I'm going to have to do it a couple of times in order to get it right. Dajatl tlingarho. Dajatl tlingarho. Which is a very, very, very bad Klingon pronunciation of do you speak Klingon?
The Uncommon Core is produced by Taylor Quimby, and you can learn more about the series, which will be airing on Thursdays throughout the spring semester, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. In the process of putting together our series, The Uncommon Core, we've uncovered college courses with often bizarre, enigmatic, eyebrow-raising names. From a marketing perspective, it's easy to see why Cornell University's gossip class might appeal. Likewise, the University of Rochester's inexplicable offering, alien sex. And yet, intriguing as they may be, at least one professor is calling for a little more clarity when it comes to naming novel classes. Rob Stevenson is associate professor at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. And Rob, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So what are some of the most perplexing course names you've come across recently?
Well, I think there's a class at Princeton entitled Getting Dressed. One of my favorites must be MIT Street Fighting Mathematics.
There, you sort of break down some of these weird class names into a few different categories because there are so many. What are the categories?
Yeah, I think it's easy to think of three different types of course. There's some that are what I call vague one-word titles. For example, Occidental College has Stupidity, and MIT has Daylight. And then there's also some courses that are just too clever to be useful. For example, The Amazing World of Bubbles at Caltech, or Those Sexy Victorians at Ole Miss.
Those Sexy Victorians.
Those Sexy Victorians. I mean, who wouldn't take that? And then the third group are those that really just need a colon. These are classes that I just felt the titles were unfinished. For example, Street Fighting Mathematics or God, Sex, and Chocolate. I really wanted a colon and something telling me a more descriptive content after that.
God, sex, and chocolate, you said.
That's the big three, apparently.
Well, I guess that sort of names it all. Well, you're a professor. What is incentivizing these vague one-word or rather sexy titles?
Well, academia is competitive. You have a finite number of students, and it's in a professor's best interest to fill their course. If you don't fill your course is not seen as viable, your course can be taken away and you can be made to teach something else that maybe you don't want to teach. So as a professor, I can totally see the value in having a sexy course title that's going to catch the student's eye and make them sign up for your course.
So what is the problem then with a vaguely named course from your perspective?
Well, I think it's from a reviewer's perspective. So one of my tasks is that I review applications for our master's degree, and I look through people's transcripts. And if you've done organic chemistry or if you've done downhill skiing, I kind of know what you did. But if you did stupidity or if you did getting dressed, I'm not really sure what that grade A or B means.
So I'm thinking about often politicians use
bizarre course names in colleges as a fodder for, you know, what's wrong with education, you know, a class devoted entirely to watching YouTube videos or for studying internet pornography or, you know, a course on Lady Gaga's rise to fame. We hear these kind of things all the time. So is it damaging outside of the university bubble?
Potentially. I think a politician could twist anything and say that it was potentially damaging and is a sign of the downfall of education. I don't think it's that far, but I think you do run the risk, especially if on a job application, if you were to list that you took, you know, Madonna 101, it might raise a question about the seriousness of your education. But I will say in their defense, once you Google the courses and you find the curricula, and most of them are available online, all these courses I've named are good courses at reputable universities that teach core valuable skills. So the content of the course isn't the problem. It's just this external view of what that zany course name could mean. Mm. I think the answer could be to have a zany, sexy name that's used internally and then maybe a publicly available, more serious, descriptive name that's helpful to other people.
Rob Stevenson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Rob Stevenson, associate professor at the Rollins School of Public Health. He's at Emory University. That's in Atlanta, Georgia. You'll find a link to his op-ed from the LA Times. You can't tell a course by its title. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we return, we're going to celebrate some of the films worth seeing that did not make the list of Golden Globe nominees. The sleepers of 2014, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Golden Globe Awards kick off the red carpet season on TV this weekend, and the numbers are in. Boyhood is predicted to win Best Picture in the drama category. Birdman expected to take home the award for Best Musical or Comedy. And Julianne Moore and Michael Keaton are favored to win Best Acting Awards. Well, that's according to the odds makers at the Wynn Las Vegas, anyway. But today we're dipping out of the spotlight to look at 2014's sleepers, those films that didn't get a Golden Globe nod but are worthy of your attention nonetheless. Here to share her picks is Amy Diaz, editor of New Hampshire's weekly paper, The Hippo, where she compiled her list of the best films of 2014. Amy, great to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Especially with the Should Have Been a Contender Awards. Okay, so let's start with the number one film on your best list of 2014, which was Guardians of the Galaxy, a blockbuster, not a Golden Globe nominee. So we're going to qualify it as a sleeper. Why isn't it a nominee?
A sleeper that made a bajillion dollars.
Exactly.
So here's my case for Guardians of the Galaxy. If you take something like The Imitation Game, which I really liked, and it has a great central performance, you know, from Benedict Cumberbatch, has a lot of great supporting actors. It's a movie about, you know, breaking the Nazi spy code. I don't want to say that it's unscrew-upable, but that's an easy movie to get a lot of prestige for and to enjoy. A movie like Guardians of the Galaxy, which is a comic book movie that came out in the summer from Marvel, of all people, with not just a comic book, but a comic book nobody's ever heard of, and that it would be the most fun I had at a theater last year, which it totally was. You know, we forget sometimes. It's not just about how important the movie is, the film is, but it's, did you have fun at the movies? And Guardians of the Galaxy was a lot of fun. It was such a great old-fashioned, you know, kind of sci-fi swashbuckling story. Chris Pratt was just a great center to that. He's like a new kind of Harrison Ford. So just all around a fun time, which people forget sometimes movies should also be fun occasionally.
All right. So your vote is Guardians of the Galaxy for number one film. You also do include some of the smaller independent films that didn't make the Golden Globes cut, including a film called Chef and Begin Again. Now, tell us about those two.
You know, both of those movies are examples. And in my list, I paired them with Grand Budapest Hotel as three movies that made me remember why I love movies. They made me leave feeling joy, which, again, how often does that happen? Mm-hmm. Chef is a total Jon Favreau production, writer, director, and star. And he plays a chef who leaves his restaurant, well, kind of is asked to leave his restaurant, and gets a food truck and rediscovers his creativity. So it's kind of a bit about food. It is, I think I describe it in my review as the porniest food porn that has ever porned. It is, it will make you so hungry. And
not to put too fine a point. Yeah.
It is so unfair that you have to see this in a theater where you're eating like popcorn or something, because there are, you know, there's pork and there's brisket and you're starving by the time you leave. But it's sort of about food and about the creative process. So Chef reminded me of how much fun making and enjoying food is. Begin Again reminded me of how much fun listening to music is, and what a great part of your life music can be, because it stars Mark Ruffalo and Keira Knightley. And they're two people who sort of find their way. They're kind of at low points in their life and find their way through music. And I like a lot of the things that that movie does. For example, not to give too much away, I think it's kind of clear when you start watching the movie, but they're not a romantic couple.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great to see a friendship form that's just a friendship. And then there's a lot of really great music and people making music scenes throughout this movie as well.
Any notable performances in either of these films?
Jon Favreau, who probably does not have the most serious, history as an actor, is actually really solid in Chef. It's kind of, he built the role for him. It's tailor-made to him and kind of to his abilities. And I would say that the same is true of Begin Again. Keira Knightley is really charming in this. And Mark Ruffalo, who's kind of awesome always, continues to be awesome in this movie.
Here is a clip of Jon Favreau from Chef. Now, he's talking to his young son in this scene about his overnight success on Twitter.
Did you post anything since last night?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I just sent a private message to somebody.
To who?
To that a-hole food critic.
You could only send private messages to people who are following you. I think you might have posted that publicly.
No, he wrote something nasty about me, and then I hit reply and let me send a message to him.
Dad, replies are public. Everybody can read them. And it looks like he retweeted it to all his 123,845 followers. And he wrote back.
What did he say?
I don't think I should read it.
Just, can you read it to me, please? Read the reply.
At Chef Carl Casper, I would rather have you sit on my face after a brisk walk on a warm day than suffer through that f***ing lava cake again.
He wrote that to me?
Okay, romantic comedies do not tend to get Oscar buzz or award buzz, but you do sing the praises of a film called The Obvious Child. Now, this is starring the Saturday Night Live alum Jenny Slate. Is this the film that was known as, quote, the abortion comedy?
Yes, it got that label, abortion comedy or abortion rom-com, it also was called. And, when I watched it, I was sort of surprised. It's really more of a coming-of-age, very late adolescence, early adulthood kind of movie. The pregnancy is not so much, it's not a, pro-choice, pro-life debate. It's much more a point in her life where she has to think about her life and where she is and kind of what she's going to do with it. She plays a comedian who's a solid young comedian, but kind of every other facet of her life is falling apart. She's just broken up with a longtime boyfriend who left her for one of her friends, and she's about to lose her day job, and kind of her parents are maybe suggesting, hey, it's time to get a real job. And so she's at that period of her life, and that's kind of what the movie is about. It's incredibly funny and sweet. I was sort of shocked at how sweet it is. While it's also got some nice sharp comedy, but has a very sweet heart at the center of it.
Okay, let's hear a clip from Obvious Child. In this scene, the character, and she's played by Jenny Slate, is talking to her friends about a guy she had a one-night stand with and how he stopped by her workplace.
I can't believe he walked into the store. That's a sign.
And that would be a sign saying...
like that I'm a present in a box and that he and I should go and start our beautiful life together.
I'm not a straight guy.
Oh, what?
But my guess is that most of them would hate that gift.
What? You're saying that a guy doesn't want a drunk pregnant girl in a box?
If you're a serial killer.
Maybe you want to tell him.
No, why? Why? You don't owe him anything. You don't even know this guy.
Maybe he just deserves to know that, like, this happened, that I'm not a psycho, and I'm going to get an abortion.
If I got someone pregnant, I would want to know.
And a scene there from Obvious Child, one of Amy Diaz's picks for a film worth watching, even if it didn't win any Golden Globe nominations. And let's move on to another film. This is a science fiction blockbuster called Edge of Tomorrow that didn't get a lot of traction. Why not?
Well, yeah, because it has a terrible title. And then maybe if you got past the title, you saw Tom Cruise and you're like, eh. But go see it. Go see it right now. I wish we could stop the show and all go see it together. It's so much fun. It stars Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, and it uses both of them just perfectly. You know, it kind of uses all of Tom Cruise's, particularly if you kind of remember him from the 80s and early 90s, his cockiness, and uses that perfectly. He plays a military. He's really a military PR guy. There's been this invasion by aliens, and he's over there to kind of help sell the war effort, and they push him into the battlefield, which he wants no part of. And he finds out after his first point in the battlefield that when he dies, he wakes up about 24 hours earlier. And that keeps happening kind of Groundhog Day style. And his character is one that is not a heroic character immediately. And so we kind of learn along with him to like him in this position. It was just so much fun.
Only one of us ever makes it.
Get in.
The only thing we haven't tried is a version where you walk away. Just go back to the farmhouse. There's a cellar, there's food. You wait there till I get back. You'll be safe.
I'm a soldier. I volunteered. I'm not walking away.
You die here. Right here. I can't save you. And if I go on and kill the Omega, you're dead. Forever.
Why does it matter what happens to me?
I wish I didn't know you. But I do.
Edge of Tomorrow did get a lot of critical praise. It was 90% on Rotten Tomatoes for critics and audiences. So why no love from the Golden Globes, do you think, Amy? I mean, is it the genre or is it the Tom Cruise
backlash?
Yeah,
aliens. I think immediately right. You have aliens, you have romance, you know, even just comedy, even though there's a whole comedy category for Golden Globes, a lot of those aren't necessarily your big laugh out loud comedies. And so I think that anything that's not The King's Speech is just going to have a hard time, you know, breaking through.
The Golden Globes are this weekend. We're talking about 2014's best sleeper films, those that didn't make the cut but are worthy of more attention. That's according to Amy Diaz, editor of The Hippo. Now, I have to ask about a horror movie that made your list, The Babadook, if I'm saying that right. This is an Australian horror film. I've heard a lot about it. Is it as terrifying as everyone says?
It's really good. And it's funny. I saw online somebody had a blog post called The Things That I Have Mistaken for The Babadook Since I've Seen The Babadook.
Well, what is Babadook?
Well, so he's this character in a book, and this single mother played by Essie Davis is reading this book to her young son, and he's, you know, she is his sole caregiver. She really doesn't have any help. And so what I think is great about this horror movie is, you know, there's this spooky character who they read about in a book, and then maybe, you know, things start happening in the house. Is he coming out of the book? So there's that. But then also she's just on the edge with stress and exhaustion and concern for her son and kind of a lack of a personal life and all of the things that go with being a parent. So that is almost as much of the horror movie as the horror part of the movie.
It's a horror that a lot of people can relate
to. Exactly. But talk about like aliens get no love at award season. Horror movie, forget it.
All right, let's hear a clip of Essie Davis playing the mother reporting an incident to the police.
I want to report someone stalking me and my child.
Can you tell us what happened?
Somebody sent me a children's book.
And?
And it contained violent and graphic images of my child and me being murdered.
Can we have a look at the book, please?
I burnt it.
You burnt it?
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about it.
He's been making phone calls to me as well.
What's he been saying?
Nothing, just making these noises.
How do you know it's the same person?
Because of what he wrote in the book.
Essie Davis there from a film called The Babadook. It's an Australian film, as you can hear from the accent. Now, I have to say, I have fallen in love with her. She's the star of a series on Netflix called Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. But I've heard great things about her performance here. What'd you think?
It's a really good performance. And, you know, kind of what I liked with that clip showed is a little bit of what she's saying sounds absurd. And that's kind of like parenting, actually. A lot of the things that drive you to the edge when you're a parent, if you describe them, people look at you like, is that what's driving you crazy? Because that's nuts. That's nothing. But that, you know, that's, I think that's one of the great things that this movie does and that she's able to do is both to play, you know, the person who's being preyed upon by something, but then also this really exhausted parent. And, you know, we should say a lot of these movies, one of the great things is that a lot of these movies are available on, you know, various streaming services or on DVD. So you can go see these. You don't have to wait, as with a lot of the big name movies, you know, that are still coming into theaters.
Like A Most Wanted Man, another performance that you praise from the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. He plays a German counter-terrorist expert who operates as a rogue agent. And he's investigating a Chechen immigrant's tie to local jihadists. Let's hear just a clip.
He doesn't want the money. He just doesn't want it.
Half radical, half rich kid, half Russian, half Chechen. Loves his mother, hates his father. You and I both know Issa Karpov has no idea what he wants.
Unmistakable voice, non-recognizable accent from Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died of a drug overdose last year. Great performance, or is there a part of, you know, the sentimental, he's done so much great work?
Well,
kind
it
of
does remind you, I mean, even the Hunger Games, when I saw the most recent one of that, I was reminded how great he is in everything. He just brought this presence to every role, even kind of a throwaway role. This is a really great performance from him. It was so good that at a certain point, I realized I wasn't even all that interested in the action of the movie. I wanted to see this character more. And the little details that he adds to this character, there's this one scene where he's running after someone and he kind of stops and huffs and puffs. And it kind of gives you something about his character. The movie itself, though, I was thinking about this. This is kind of like The Wire of spy movies in that it's a movie about how the people on the kind of the bottom part of the system who are maybe trying to do well, trying to act carefully, they oftentimes get crushed or are, you know, have their plans really destroyed by people at the top of the system who maybe need to meet numbers. So if you liked The Wire, kind of that mindset, institutions and how they can have mistakes, I think that this movie is really good. And then particularly because of this performance.
Well, Amy, we have to draw to a close. But which film do you think will take home the Golden Globe for Best Picture drama?
Well, so, you know, I did do a lot of digging around myself. Everyone seems to be saying Boyhood. That's not an unwarranted win. I mean, it took 12 years to make that movie. And I think that alone, especially for movie people, that has to be praised.
Amy Diaz here, getting us off the beaten path. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amy Diaz is editor of New Hampshire's weekly paper, The Hippo. And you can find her list of the best and worst films of 2014 on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. What was your favorite film of the year? You can tell us if it was a blockbuster, a sleeper, or even a guilty pleasure. Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Any archivist will tell you that preserving history's earliest films is a difficult, delicate, but valuable process. And as file formats and software become obsolete, the same can be said for digital imagery. A giant facility in Culpeper, Virginia, is collecting and preserving the largest assortment of audio, video, and film recordings on the planet. So what happens when you take a former Cold War bunker and fill it with such a rich collection? Rebecca Shear journeyed to this special branch of the Library of Congress and brings us the story.
Racing to save our country's audiovisual history sounds an awful lot like this. And this. And this. It even sounds like this.
Well, this line is busy. Ring off. You got the wrong number.
Well, I might have the wrong number, but I got the right party, see?
Well, this is a party line.
actually can't play it much more than that. A defect in the cylinder makes the needle start jumping out like crazy. Mm.
That's audio engineer Rob Cristarella working with a wax cylinder from the early 1900s.
Well, actually, 1913, this particular cylinder.
Okay, a wax cylinder from 1913. And he's just one of many engineers and archivists in this half-million-square-foot facility literally built into the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Its name is kind of a mouthful.
The Library of Congress Packard Campus for Audiovisual Conservation in Culpeper, Virginia.
Is there a sort of an acronym for that?
We usually just refer to it as the Packard Campus.
Fair enough. Mike Michon heads the moving image section at the Packard Campus, so he knows all about those first three sounds we just heard. One, a 1915 romantic comedy shot on 28mm film being transferred to more durable 35mm. Two, a 2-inch quad videotape of the David Susskind show being transferred to digital. And three, a 3/4-inch videotape, in this case early episodes of All My Children, being transferred to digital by, I kid you not, a robot. Because the Library of Congress houses the Copyright Office, Packard receives 30,000 items for copyright every year. If you add in all the stuff sent in as donations,
we have roughly 1.2 million moving image items and about
over 3 million sound recordings.
As a total radio nerd, I just got so excited when you said that. That second guy, the one who made my heart go pitter-pat, is Matthew Barton. He's Packard's curator of recorded sound, like those old wax cylinders, which engineers are working to digitize.
So this black cylinder I'm holding, when does this date back to?
Probably sometime between 1898 and 1912.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I just started shaking when you said that.
Then you better let me hold it.
Okay, I seriously need to stop geeking out here. But it's hard because, as Barton points out, the Library of Congress collects and preserves all kinds of amazing sound.
We've got 78s, LPs, 45s.
Not to mention a zillion kinds of tape, even player piano rolls. And if this next tidbit doesn't make your heart go pitter-pat, I don't know what will. The Packard Campus facility is actually a Cold War bunker. I am not joking. Here, Mike Michon will back me up.
The original facility that was here was owned by the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Virginia. It was built in the 1970s, and at its peak, it stored $3 billion in coin and currency, which was going to be used to restart the U.S. economy east of the Mississippi in the event of a nuclear war.
See, told you I wasn't joking.
And in 1997, the Packard Humanities Institute purchased that with the idea of converting it for storage for the moving image and sound recording collections, along with some preservation laboratories.
That's Packard as in David Woodley Packard, the philanthropist son of Hewlett Packard's co-founder. In July 2007, Packard donated the campus to the Library of Congress. His donation tied with Wolf Trap as the second biggest private sector gift the federal government had ever seen. The biggest is the Smithsonian Institution. And now, as a result, we have this massive, multi-storied, mostly underground labyrinth of preservation labs, recording studios, and concrete storage vaults.
Okay, it's a little chilly in here.
39 degrees Fahrenheit, 30% relative humidity.
But then how else are you going to preserve 124 vaults of nitrate film?
Each one of these vaults holds roughly 1,500 cans of film. Now, why do we have such small vaults? Should a fire event occur, you might lose an entire vault, but you wouldn't lose your entire collection.
See, nitrate film was all the rage until 1951, when cellulose acetate took over. Nitrate is highly flammable. It creates its own oxygen, so if it catches fire, not even water will put out the flames, which has led to many a sad story in the annals of cinema.
A lot of Swedish film history was lost because the nitrate caught on fire as bomb during World War II.
And as recently as 1978, a fire at the National Archives in Suitland, Maryland, obliterated 12 million feet of film.
Because when the fire department showed up, in order to release pressure in the building, they opened up the vault doors, which allowed the fire to spread from vault to vault to vault, which is exactly what you're not supposed to do.
That sad event taught the Packard folks a lot about fire safety and prevention, which Michonne explains after leading me into one of the studio collection vaults.
We're going to go into one of our Columbia vaults here.
It's nice and chilly, of course, lined with cubbies, each holding two film canisters. In the event of fire, there's a chimney to help funnel smoke and overhead water sprinklers to help... Wait, didn't we just say water can't put out a nitrate fire?
So what's the point of having... water sprinklers.
What is the point of having water sprinklers?
I'm really glad that you asked, Rebecca. Let's say a fire event does occur. A wall of water is released that would coat all of the shelves that you see in this small vault, and it would allow the fire to sort of burn out within the cubby.
So you might lose like a reel or two?
But you wouldn't lose anything else in the vault. We fear fire much more than we fear water.
But the other thing they fear at the Packard campus, Michonne says, is time. So many of the film, video, and audio recordings they've collected have a shelf life. I mean, 28mm film degrades. 2-inch quad videotape wears out. Cylinders get damaged. That's why it's so important to get all this stuff cataloged and preserved.
And we're not preserving it for the sake of preserving it. We want people to be able to hear and see what's gone before.
Because then, Mike Michonne says, not only might we figure out who we were and who we are, but who we might become. I'm Rebecca Shear.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening. There's much more to hear and to explore at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about some of the best underappreciated films of 2014, and we'd love to hear from you. What was your favorite film of the year? Was it nominated for a Golden Globe? Should it have been a contender? You can join the discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Sometimes the best suggestions come to us from word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.